Not all of Casey Stengel's players found him as amusing as the public did, and as we do to this day, in part because his wit could be very cutting and hurtful. He was not sentimental about too many players, and maybe that was just smart. He managed a lot of teams over a lot of decades, and you can't get attached to the players, not overmuch, or you won't be able to make the hard judgments that you need to. Earl Weaver used to say some of the same kinds of things, that he didn't want to be friendly to the players, not because he was a jerk, although some people would say that he certainly was, particularly umpires, but because it's hard to cut a friend from the roster after he hits 115 and 60 spring training at-bats. A couple of weeks back on this show, Will Leach was talking about Mike Matheny's tenure with the Cardinals and how the Cardinals front office had to make moves to protect Matheny from his loyalty to certain veterans. They had to actually get the guys out of town to stop Matheny from playing them. And I was reminded of Joe Torre, who so enjoyed having Bernie Williams around that he couldn't get him out of center field or couldn't drop him in the order, couldn't diminish his role in the offense, even at the point that it was obvious to everyone else that Bernie's prime, and what a great prime it was, had come to an end. There was always a lot of talk in the media in those days about certain players being Joe's guys and other players not being able to break into that group. Casey didn't have any guys. He had one, in the sense that it says on Billy Martin's plaque in Monument Park at Yankee Stadium that he was Casey's boy. But guess what? When Casey had a choice between seeing his boy traded and staging some sort of protest, well, he let his boy be traded because in the end his boy was a distraction and wasn't all that good, really. According to every account of that moment, he wept, but he did it. By all accounts, he was a tremendously nice man off the field. But he understood that in baseball his job was to win and that the roster must be shaped ruthlessly or you are not going to do that. Now, whether he could have maintained that attitude and been more gentle in his overall relations with the players, been more diplomatic, that's a separate issue. But with the distance of time and whatever feelings of emotional injury the players might have suffered far in the past, it's easy to laugh at some of the things he did in that regard. And one of my favorite stories about the way that he spoke to players is extremely brief, and it's simply this. I don't know which pitcher it was, but in one game, the pitcher was getting shelled, and Casey went out to the mound to make a change. And the pitcher said, "I'm not tired yet." And Casey said, "I know, but I'm tired of you." For most of us, life doesn't afford nearly enough opportunities to be as blunt as all that. I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is The Infinite Inning. To get right into it today because we only have time for a bit of an attenuated episode because I, as you hear this, am on vacation, sort of a vacation, a trip to the in-laws, which can be a vacation, may not be the vacation you might have chosen if your in-laws didn't have to be visited. That's a duty we all have to perform, but it's always a difficulty when you have this one window for a vacation, and you think, should I go to Hawaii? Should I see Paris? Shall I visit London and ride the double-decker buses? I have always wanted to go to Salt Lake City and see the Mormon Tabernacle Choir in action. But no, the in-laws are none of those places. And the in-laws, who are swell people, do need to be visited. And I promise you, I am not complaining about the fact that I am being shanghaied to the deep south. Yes, I'm complaining. Who am I kidding? Wow. And I'm basically traveling by rickshaw, so that's humane. That's demeaning to both the person pulling the rickshaw and the person riding it. I may, in fact, in this instance, be both. No, in all seriousness, I do prize my in-laws. I prize the trip. It's some time for me, particularly with my kids before school resumes. And this year is a special year for me in that regard because for the first time, one of my two children is going away to college. And that's going to be a big adjustment and a big emotional thing to get through for me because, as opposed to Casey, who I was just talking about, Casey did not have children. He was married for many, many years, but never had kids. Well, in my case, I do, and I am sentimental about my children. So it's going to be difficult for me when the day comes. And so I relish this long, slow trip to Mosquito Land, to the Okefenokee Swamp, or wherever the heck I'm going. And I know you'll appreciate that not just in deference to me. They're my family, so they have similar interests to mine. Not 100% of a match, which is as it should be, but there will be many stops of historical and baseball interest along the way, including one major league game and one minor league game, and I realize there's a possibility of a second major league game, so it's going to be a good time. Peanuts and Cracker Jacks and the All-American Alligator. Whenever I go to some historical site, I always feel a little self-conscious, as if I might be the only one who thought to do the thing that I'm doing because it's somehow touristy or because no one is alive who cares anymore. And I've been in places where I've walked through, say, the house of some long dead president, and it's just me and a bunch of other people who I think were contemporaries of that long dead president. They voted for John Adams. I'm the only one in the place who has any color left in his hair and is still breathing with both lungs. You know, on July 4th, 1826, when Adams passed away, famously, the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. Jefferson died that day as well. Adams was at least initially well enough to go to the window and talk to the people who were serenading him and cheering for him, knowing that he was one of the great shepherds of independence. And he said something like, "My fellow Americans, I give you liberty." Which is a great line, like it works on two levels, right? Like he personally gave them liberty, and on another level he's just saying, hey, here it is. But I've turned to the guy next to me and I realized he was there. So he knows because he was present, and I know because I read the books, and when both of us are gone, I'm not sure who will be there. And I was thinking about this earlier today because this week for me, last week by the time you're hearing this, it was the 70th anniversary of the passing of Babe Ruth. And there's a Twitter account that I follow. You may follow it too. It has a lot of followers. It's at B Smile. The full title of it is Baseball by B Smile. And it's a fellow or a woman, I don't know, who tweets images about baseball mostly. And that individual tweeted a picture of Babe Ruth, an older Babe Ruth, and wrote, 70 years ago today, Babe Ruth passes away at age 53. R.I.P. Bambino, the baseball world will never forget you. And I thought, well, wait a minute, I'm not sure of that proposition if it's true. Yes, the baseball world, that's an important qualifier. If you are highly invested in baseball, then yeah, most likely you know who Babe Ruth was and you have some appreciation of what he did. But then again, I know of a story of a baseball player, and you've heard this kind of thing before, but Mel Hall, who was a true reprobate, who played for the Yankees in the early 1990s. Now, I, once again, a story for another time, and maybe not one I really want to tell, because, well, you can look it up, as Casey Stengel would say. It wasn't that he was an extremely low on base percentage player, with limited defensive skills in the outfield that convinced Buck Showalter that he had to go. It wasn't that he was almost criminally harassing a young Bernie Williams in the Yankees clubhouse that convinced him, or that he had a tendency to bring wild animals into said clubhouse, by which I do not mean raccoons. I mean that accounts differ as to whether we're talking about tigers or lions or cheetahs or leopards or what. But simply this, that the Yankees had one of their great old-timers' days, an affair that they have tended to do over the years as well or better, I would venture to say, than any other team because of the sheer magnitude of the players that they were able to bring back. And Mel Hall was standing in the dugout with Buck Showalter as the announcer, Bob Shepard, at that time, called out, "Number 8, Yogi Berra. Number 8. I'm not really trying to do a Bob Shepard impersonation. I'm not good at voices, as you know. Number 16, Whitey Ford. Number 16. Number 7, Mickey Mantle. Number 7. And he turned to Buck Showalter and he said, "Who the fuck are these geezers?" And that was when Buck Showalter had to know. So no, maybe not even the baseball world, but this trip that I'm about to take really focused me on this, and not that I'm going to this place, but I've visited Mount Vernon, the home of George Washington, twice in my life, once as a child, once much later. And there's one significant difference between visiting Washington's home, his plantation, when I was a child, and now, and it's simply this, that in the intervening years, they had to build an elaborate visitor center to explain to those people coming to visit, to Americans coming to visit, whose house it was and why he was important. They did not know. They had not been taught. Or if they had been taught, they hadn't paid attention. First in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen? Fat chance. They wouldn't have even known first in war, first in peace, and last in the American League, as people used to say of the Washington Senators. They did not know who George Washington was. So, Babe Ruth, how many people, I mean, in your life, if you ask them, they don't have to be baseball fans. In fact, in terms of American cultural literacy, they shouldn't be baseball fans. They should just know. Ask them. Do me a favor and just go around to a few people and ask during your lunch hour, whenever it's convenient, and say, who was Babe Ruth and why was he important? The only thing that I don't understand about that whole situation with Mount Vernon that I just told you is, who are all these people who are agreeing to visit this house out in the middle of Virginia? I mean, it's not far outside of Washington, but still, you have to make a point of going there. It's not like you're going to turn a corner looking for a Starbucks and there's this massive mansion on the banks of the Potomac. No, you have to go there. Who are all these people agreeing that they're going to go to this place and not know why they're there? I mean, does anyone even go to the multiplex and say, what theater is this? Number 16. What's playing in it? I don't know. Which one did we buy a ticket for? Not sure of that either. Well, I guess we'll just watch whatever comes on. That's sort of similar to saying, hey, look at that house in the distance. It's kind of big, and it's got a cupola. I love cupolas. Well, turn up ahead. We'll just go check it out. Oh, look, they let people in. Let's go see the cupola. Should have taken that left turn at Pismo Beach. But I digress. As always, what I wanted to tell you is that this is a somewhat shortened show. No guest, no conversation this week. Just a couple of stories like that one that are on my mind. And then out until next week when we will resume, assuming I make it back in one piece, our regularly scheduled programming. I couldn't bear to be away from you long enough to skip a week, though. So, shall we take a break and hope that, in actuality, Yogi Berra really did say, when you come to a fork in the road, take it, because I'm going to need that kind of directional help. And when we return, a couple of more tales from The Infinite Inning.
Thank you.
It's intended as a compliment, but one of the cruelest things you can say to a person is they have potential. Because what is potential but unactivated ability? What if they never get to activate it? How do you know when they do? More importantly, how do they know? If they believe you, then what you've done is placed an undefined goal somewhere in front of them, and they might spend their whole lives groping towards it without knowing where it is or if it even exists. And by exists, I mean that your original supposed insight might have been wrong. Maybe they just are what they are, and whatever talent that you perceive to be there, whatever potential, is not potential at all. It's just imaginary. After all, you're not clairvoyant, and in the end, their potential was just your opinion. What if you further misread the situation such that though they did not have that potential at all, you encouraged them to believe that they were, in fact, in the act of fulfilling that potential when the whole thing was just kind of a momentary illusion? In the mid-1920s, the New York Giants had four different starting second basemen in 4 years for reasons that mostly had very little to do with the performance of the players themselves. Frankie Frisch had started most of the games at second from 1922 through 1924. In 1925, Frisch broke the metacarpal of the ring finger on his right hand on a play at the plate and missed over a month. That allowed Giants manager John McCraw to move his agile first baseman George High Pockets Kelly, who I mentioned just last week, over to the keystone. He had the ability, the defensive ability, to do both, and get first baseman Bill Terry, who'd been sitting on the bench for a couple of years, into the lineup. When Frisch came back, McGraw liked the way Terry was hitting enough to leave things as they were, and Frisch spent the rest of the year playing some shortstop and third, and he had both the bat and the glove to sustain both those positions. The next year, for whatever reason, everything went back to the way it had been, with Frisch starting at second, Kelly at first, and Bill Terry on the bench. It didn't stay that way, though, not because anyone got hurt, but because in August of that season, Frisch reached a personal breaking point with McGraw. He was the team captain, and McGraw had brought him directly out of college to the bench and brought him up as a kind of baseball son. But making Frisch the head of the team meant, in McGraw's mind, that he was responsible for whenever someone else screwed up. If Frisch went 4-for-5 in a game, but the center fielder dropped a fly ball, then McGraw called him all kinds of names in the clubhouse after the game. If Frisch made a diving stop to save two runs, but the reason he had to make that diving stop is the catcher called a fastball when he should have called a curve, McGraw ripped him in the clubhouse after the game. And when I say ripped, McGraw's ability to say vile things about a player was legendary. He was one of the managers who taught Casey Stengel to be as Casey Stengel was, but they expressed themselves in different ways. Casey could be bitingly sarcastic, but he wouldn't try to destroy a person, and McGraw did. By 1926, Frisch had been going through this to one extent or another for 8 years, and on August 20th, when McGraw blew up after the Giants played some sloppy defense against the Cardinals in St. Louis, Frisch said, you know what? Nothing is worth this. I'm going home. He stayed away from the team for about 2 weeks before being convinced to return, but everyone knew it was over in terms of his relationship with the Giants. Simultaneously, the Cardinals wanted to get rid of Rogers Hornsby for a whole bunch of reasons that we can go through in another show, but suffice it to say that the owner decided that Hornsby was a sub-replacement-level human being and wanted him gone, even though he had just played and managed the Cardinals to a 7-game World Series win over the Yankees. That's how much he disliked the guy. Well, I can go a bit further and say that it had something to do not just with Hornsby's general demeanor, which was awful, but with unpaid gambling debts and Hornsby's decision to skip his own mom's funeral, which made the owner of the Cardinals, Sam Breeden, say, "What kind of man are you?" So both teams were motivated sellers, and that December, Hornsby was traded to New York for Frisch and a washed-up pitcher named Jimmy Ring. So Hornsby is your giant second baseman for 1927, and on a lot of levels, he kicked ass. He played in every game, he hit .361 with 25 home runs, and more than that, because McGraw was badly distracted with personal matters, he even managed the team for several chunks of the season. See, in the early 20s, there was this huge Florida land bubble. The value of real estate was increasing so rapidly, they were dredging the beaches to create more beaches. They invented Boca Raton overnight just so they could sell it to the saps. And McGraw had gotten involved with a development called Pennant Park. Yes, you could buy a home from John McGraw and live on Christy Mathewson Way. McGraw had put a lot of his accumulated savings into Pennant Park and had gotten a lot of pals to invest in Pennant Park as well. And, well, to oversimplify greatly, in 1926, a hurricane wiped Miami temporarily off the map, and every man, woman, and child and house pet in America kind of simultaneously woke up, rubbed their eyes, and said, "Holy moly, Florida is a totally untenable place to live." And so the bubble burst, and McGraw and all his investors were wiped out. Here's another thing I don't know. Exactly when amnesia set in and people decided Florida was all right to return to and build in and so forth, man, are they going to be in for the same rude awakening when the sea levels continue to rise. But that is another story and perhaps an entirely different show from this one. McGraw was still trying to sort all this out in 27, so that gave Hornsby the opportunity to take over the team. Of course, Hornsby alienated the veteran Giants players. He alienated everybody, basically. And it was hard for some of those players to, say, take lectures from Hornsby on defense when he himself was a fairly terrible second baseman. Imagine if Daniel Murphy was traded to the Rockies and started telling Nolan Arenado how to play third base. It was kind of like that. He also alienated Giants ownership, which tended to be heavily involved with the team, and when they tried to talk to him about it and question some of his moves, he told them off. In January 1928, he was traded to the Braves in a deal that McGraw claimed not to even know about. And Hornsby said, "I hit .361, I played second base, and managed the club on two Western trips. What does a fella have to do to stay in New York?" Well, when the owner asks you why you made a pitching change, you might not tell him to perform an anatomically impossible act. But that's not the kind of thing that ever occurred to Rogers Hornsby in a long, long career as a player and a manager. So he was gone. But here was an opportunity for John McGraw because he could try Andy Cohen at second base. And this fulfilled a long time desire on McGraw's part. For years, he had thought that the key to conquering the Big Apple baseball market was to get some good Jewish players. He felt certain that attendance would swell as the Hebraic hometown fans came flooding into the Polo Ground. Hank Greenberg was at that moment 16 years old and was probably about a block over, but never mind, he wasn't on their radar yet and somehow never got on their radar. So Andy, 28, is in. And because he's the replacement for Rogers freaking Hornsby, everyone is invested in this player. And not just Jewish fans, but John McGraw and the Giants ownership and front office, obviously, because they have made this swap, which took everyone by surprise, dealing a recognized all-time great hitter for no one in particular. And forgive me, I haven't mentioned that the trade was Hornsby for catcher Shanty Hogan and outfielder Jimmy Welsh. And they've replaced him with this kid. So Giants fans who are perhaps less invested in the religious identity of their infielders are sharpening their knives and forks to carve up the team with criticism should Cohen flop. The sports writers certainly were. And then an amazing thing happened. Cohen did not flop. In his first four games, Cohen went 8-for-15 with a home run. And now the sports writers, who had been ready to write one kind of story, started writing a different kind of story. Instead of the rookie flop and the Giants' folly, they started talking about the Giants' venom and the new star that was going to make Manhattan forget Rogers Hornsby. And when they asked Hornsby about this, especially after his first four games, when he had hit a mere .267, he said one of the few wise and kind things of his life. He said, "That ain't fair to the kid. As soon as I get going, I'll lose him. And that's exactly what happened. Cohen didn't come back to Earth all at once. He actually finished the first half with a very respectable 295 average and 451 slugging percentage. Not bad at all for a middle infielder. But in the second half, I don't know whether he tired out or pitcher simply figured him out a bit, but in the second half, he hit pretty much nothing for that place and time, 250 with a 300 on base percentage and a 347 slugging percentage. Simultaneously, Hornsby, though he was playing in Braves Field, which was one of the great pitcher's parks in history, with fences that you needed binoculars to see, and a perpetual cold wind blowing in, won the batting title at 387, and although no one noticed this at the time because this stat didn't really exist, had a 498 on base and slugged 632. And you can bet that that is over a 200 OPS plus, because park adjust for that place, well, let me just put it this way. Hornsby had to hit 401 on the road to get to those figures. Park and league adjust Andy Cohen's final OPS, and you get 87. McGraw brought him back in 1929, but he got hurt, only played in 101 games, and although he did average 294, he neither walked nor hit with any power, and was replaced by Huey Kritz, a glove man, the following season. Now the sports writers prepared to tell a third kind of story, that of the player who was spoiled by his own success. And whose fault was it? The Jews. I feel like I've said that before. I feel like I've had cause to cite that before. But at least this version is a little more humorous than the typical version of that unfortunately pervasive sentiment throughout history, which was, and this was written in the Sporting News by Dan Daniel, who was himself Jewish, that matzo balls and gefilte fish, that's a quote, ruined Cohen. The Upper Broadway herring teasers got the big series of banquets underway, and Cohen couldn't run around the bases without finishing the last quarter on his hands and knees. Or maybe it's just that sometimes prospects don't develop, things don't pan out. Almost everyone is going to look worse compared to Rogers Hornsby than they would have looked following anybody else. Any number of things. Maybe because our information about injuries from that time isn't great. Maybe Andy Cohen had a bad appendix or a ripped hamstring or any other number of career-altering maladies. I mean, these things happen. But no, you see, it had to be somebody's fault because they had said that he was doing it. They had been taken in by the small sample, or more likely just by the story that they wanted to tell. And then, because Cohen showed them up by making liars out of them, they had to find someone to blame. As I said, potential is a curse, and once someone says that you have something like Roger Hornsby's ability, or you're going to exceed what Rogers Hornsby did, unless it's in the I love you, Mom department, you're doomed to a life of disappointment and a double vengeance. The first is the one that you take on yourself when you find yourself disillusioned with the power of their prediction. And the second is the one that they take on you when they themselves become disillusioned.
Haircut, simply terrible necktie. The worst bearing, just unbearable. What to tackle first? Still, you've got possibilities, though you're horribly square. I see possibilities underneath. There's something there.
You're listening to You've Got Possibilities, a song from the 1966 Broadway musical It's a Bird, It's a Plane, It's Superman, written by Charles Strauss and Lee Adams, the same team that composed the songs, more famously, for Bye Bye Birdie. The singer is Linda Lavin, later to be famous as the star of the long-running Alice sitcom. We'll take a break for a moment of quiet contemplation, a word from our sponsor, or perhaps a spark of divine intervention, and then I'll be back with more from The Infinite Inning.
You're improvable, it won't take long. Mountain. not you yet, you'll be shy. When I get through, come on and roll, you tiger, you!
So will you have one more for the road? I don't really have a good reason for telling this story except because of where I'm going. Once every other year or so, I find myself, for the family reasons I alluded to earlier, hauling off to the great state of Mississippi. I did not, at any point in my life, growing up first in Greenwich Village as a child and then in New Jersey as a slightly older child, plan on having any involvement with Mississippi whatsoever, and for good reason. A, it is very far away from New York and New Jersey. Second of all, on most surveys of the states, whether it's poverty level, level of education, split between red and blue, Mississippi ranks 60th out of 50. I bet you didn't know that was possible. It was also the home state of Jefferson Davis and the place where Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney were murdered, and Medgar Evers, and Emmett Till, and oh God, the list goes on and on. I can't believe I'm going there. It is a place that I would like to spend my life deploring rather than visiting. Funny thing, though, I've been there a number of times now over the last 20-plus years, and Mississippi is not filled with Trump voters or murderers of civil rights workers. It's just filled with people. And like any other group of people, you have to treat them as individuals. Anytime you take a pile of hundreds of thousands or millions of people and start thinking of them as a monolithic whole with identical attitudes, with identical faults and tastes and what have you, you've become part of the problem. And so, let me offer a revised promotional slogan for Mississippi from the perspective of someone who hails from the much denigrated state of New Jersey. Mississippi, I don't hate it. Mississippi was, in a lot of ways, the slavery state, and I point this out not to go back to bashing them, but because this translates to baseball in a kind of fascinating way. When the slaves were freed, many of them picked up surnames related to the people who had held them in bondage or the places where they had been held in bondage. To give one example, one of the biggest slaveholding families in the country was the Hairstons. They actually franchised. They started in Virginia in the 1730s, but as cotton became more profitable than old crops like tobacco and indigo and rice, they started establishing satellite plantations in what was then the West. They did this through marriage and through sending cousins out and so forth. They pronounced their name Harston, by the way, or Hoston, and they still do. One of their plantations was at Crawford, Mississippi. Well, Sam Hairston, who was one of the first African-American ballplayers in the American League, albeit very briefly, and after, was the progenitor of a family of players that has included his sons Jerry and John Hairston, and his grandsons, Jerry's sons, Jerry and Scott. Well, he was born in Crawford in 1920. I don't think that's a coincidence. I do not know who Sam Hairston's parents or grandparents were, but it seems reasonable to assume a connection to the Harston plantation in Crawford. I used to wonder about ex-slaves taking the surnames of the people who had owned them. I thought, why would you want to create a memorial to that relationship? Then I thought it had happened out of mere convenience, but the more I think about it, I like it as an act of annexation. These haughty slavers who thought that they could own other people had lost the exclusive use of their family names to their former hostages. Anyway, regardless of how the Hairston-Harston thing developed and found its way into baseball, you could make a very good all-star team out of players who were born in Mississippi, and not just from retired greats like Dave Parker, Frank White, Ellis Burks, Chet Lemon, Roy Oswalt, but active guys like Brian Dozier and Corey Dickerson. And then, and this is why I've gone in this direction, because I just kind of like thinking about this guy on days like this when I'm prepared to depart for the Louisiana Territory, was Gerald Walker, G. Walker, who spent the best part of his career with the Detroit Tigers in the 1930s. He was born in Gulfport, a town on, appropriately enough, the Gulf Coast. I have been to the Walmart in Gulfport. But That's really all I can tell you about the place. It seems like everywhere else. Some good players have come out of Gulfport too, not just G, but the former Twins outfielder Matt Lawton, White Sox third baseman Bill Melton, who led the American League in home runs in 1971, and current Yankees reliever Jonathan Holder. I just included him in a list of good players. I guess he was a good player. He was a center and left fielder. His stats look exactly like Ken Griffey Sr.'s, and if you remember the original Griffey, he was a 295, 300 hitter in his best years, might hit 15 or so home runs and steal 20, 25 bases. Walker's numbers aren't as good, though, despite being identical, because he compiled them in a segregated high offense league in the 1930s, and Griffey did his work in the integrated low offense 1970s and 1980s. The larger difference, though, was that G was kind of an idiot. How many players have you heard of whose manager suspended them 10 days at midseason just for stupid base running? That was G in 1934, and it happened because he was picked off by the catcher twice in the same inning at two different bases. He simply wasn't paying attention, and after the game, Mickey Cochran, whose nervous breakdown from managing and being hit in the head by pitches over and over again I have detailed in prior episodes of this series, actually called a team meeting and asked for the players to support him by vote in purging G. Walker. And they voted against their manager. They didn't recognize a cry for help when they saw it, but G was always a popular guy, a fan favorite in Detroit, and I guess his teammates liked him too. Well, Cochran kept him on the team, but he didn't use him all that much after that. In the World Series against the Cardinals that year, he didn't start, but in Game 2, he came to bat in the bottom of the ninth, Tigers trailing 2-1, and a runner on second. He lined a single to center field to tie the game, and then, as he was standing on first base, he started arguing with the players heckling him from the Cardinals' dugout. He wandered off the bag to continue the argument and was picked off by the catcher again. I really feel for Mickey Cochran. Walker was once caught stealing during an intentional walk, which is reported in a couple of players, but I've looked for the box score and the play-by-play. I haven't found it, and it is very hard to figure out exactly how that happened. One of my favorite G. Walker caught stealings came in a game against the A's at Detroit in July 1937. They were supposed to play two, but conditions were so wet that they only got through six innings of the first game before quitting. The field was a swamp. It was raining the whole time. Walker homered in the game, and the Tigers won. So I don't want to exaggerate the impact of his bad judgment here, but in the fourth inning he walked and decided that this would be a good time to steal second. Well, he made it, but as most of you know, if you've ever driven on a rainy day, you need to adjust your stopping distance for the slick conditions. Walker slid into second base and just kept on going, water jetting up around him as he sailed on into short left field, where the Philadelphia shortstop eventually caught up with him and tagged him out. Yankees manager Joe McCarthy always coveted Walker for some reason, even though he tended to hate Southerners, but he had a great line about all this. McCarthy said, "They say he's crazy on the bases, but you can't be crazy on the bases without getting on." That strikes me as something that might have made Mickey Cochran cry. It is much easier to say when the player isn't on your team. G was sometimes referred to in the press as the Mississippi Rebel, a nickname I am fairly certain we would not bestow on a player today. What he was often rebelling against was common sense. In 1941, the Sporting News ran a profile of him by one H.G. Salzinger. It includes this great passage. Walker's six-year career in Detroit has puzzled baseball men. It would puzzle psychologists. One day, a star player of the American League asked me, "Will you kindly tell me how a player who is an atrocious base runner, an erratic fielder, and a haphazard hitter can be a great idol? How a man can make one bad mistake after another and still remain amazingly popular?" He mentioned no name, but I needed only one chance to guess that the subject of the inquiry was Walker. Gee's popularity both puzzled and nettled my questioner, who was one of the leading three players in the American League. The answer was not difficult. Walker's popularity in Detroit was based upon errors. He made mistakes in fielding, base running, and sometimes in batting, but his errors were, in the main, the result of overtrying, and the majority of other players err because they don't try enough. There is something about perfection and near perfection that alienates the average citizen. He cannot get enthusiastic over perfection, although he respects it. He feels no affinity with a Joe DiMaggio, a flawless stylist who comes closer to outfield perfection than any man since the days of Tris Speaker, but he feels a close affinity with a Gerald Holmes Walker who misjudges fly balls, misplays ground balls, throws to the wrong pillow, gets caught off base, and becomes trapped between bases. The average man has nothing in common with a DiMaggio, but he has a great deal in common with a Gerald Walker who bungles here and there, but who keeps right on trying. Human friendship and sympathy are claimed by the sinner and not by the saint. We can all understand the sinner. He's one of us. Let that sink in for a second, because it explains a lot. It is very profound, and not just about baseball, but a lot of other things that I will not point out. I will let you come to the conclusion for yourself. I will let the obvious things remain unspoken for once, and I will continue by saying that Walker was so much one of us that during his career, which ran from 1931 through 1945, he made 154 errors, which led all outfielders during that period. In fairness, another outfielder, one Bruce Campbell, had a slightly lower fielding percentage. Bruce fielded 932 for the 1932 Browns. How does an outfielder do that? Do you fall down on every play? If you make a play in the gap, do you keep the ball and throw in the center fielder? And here's another question. Those ball-playing Southern Walkers of the 30s and 40s are confusing as hell, even to me, who does this for a living. There was G and his brother Hub, who were from Mississippi, and then there were Dixie Walker and his brother Harry. Dixie was born in Georgia, but Harry was also born in Mississippi, in Pascagoula. The latter two were associated with incidents of racism. The former two, insofar as I know, were not. And that is, of course, a very important distinction. The conclusion to this story of G. Walker, such as it is that in 1955, long after his playing career was over, he was working with the Orlando Saratomas in the Florida State League. I am intentionally not looking up the meaning of Saratoma because I prefer to think of it as something you get and then you go to the urologist and he gives you a shot and it clears up. I can't lie to you, I did try to look it up and Google auto-corrected it to seroma, which is defined as a pocket of clear serous fluid that sometimes develops in the body after surgery. So I rest my case. One of the future major leaguers on the 55 Saratomas was Choo Choo Coleman of the 62 Mets, which just feels right. That September, G was out fishing with brother Hub when a bad thing happened. I sometimes see this written up as G having decided, for whatever G-like reasons, to dive into an empty swimming pool. And that's not true. Instead, he dove into an empty lake. Well, there had to be some water in the lake, because he had just been fishing in it. But he dove in headfirst off the dock into what was apparently very shallow water, struck his head, and didn't come back up. When he didn't surface, Hub thought G was kidding around because this is G Walker. Why wouldn't you think that? Fortunately, he figured it out just in time and saved his brother. Newspaper reports say it took 15 minutes to bring G back around, which I think reflects less the fact that he had half drowned than that he was concussed and worse. All four of his limbs were paralyzed. I would not tell you this story in anything like the tone that I have taken with it if G had spent the rest of his life as a quadriplegic. He eventually did recover. and in fact recovered quickly enough that he was able to manage the Saratomas a bit in 1956. He lived another 25 years, in fact, passing in 1981, back in Jackson, Mississippi. I looked up the obituaries in the Detroit papers. They're vanishingly small, and I think it's because the old saying is true. The evil that men do lives on after them, while the good is oft interred with their bones. And, by the way, the base running mistakes that they do is interred with their bones as well. And so that is where I am going to take my leave of you and G. Walker II, back in Jackson and fading into vanishing memory. Or is that vanishing into fading memory? Well, hopefully I don't. Hopefully I'll be back at the regularly scheduled time a week from now. And so, from the bottom of my heart to you and all of yours, be well until then. And for gosh sakes, don't be caught stealing on an intentional walk.
We got married in a fever, hotter than a pepper sprout. We've been talking about Jackson ever since the fire went out. I'm going to Jackson, I'm gonna mess around. Yeah, I'm going to Jackson, look out Jackson town.
We'll go on down to Jackson, go ahead and wreck your hell. Go play your hand, you big talk man, make a big fool of yourself. Yeah,
by the night they drove old Dixie down, we have come to the end of another episode. You can follow me on Twitter at Go Stephen Goldman. Why Go Stephen Goldman? Because, as I've spent most of the last hour explaining, I'm gone, okay? You can also write to us, by which I mean me, at infiniteinning@gmail.com, and there's a Facebook group. Go to Facebook, search Infinite Inning, knock, I will let you in, and we will have a good old time together. Just like Johnny and June here. Well, maybe not just like Johnny and June here. We have a sponsor now, but nevertheless, this episode is brought to you by the number 6. Our producer is Yaknapatafa Harold. Our theme song is called The Infinite Man. You have heard it throughout this episode, but are not, in fact, listening to it now. This, as I just said, is June Carter and Johnny Cash from 1967, singing Jackson, written by Mike Lieber and Billy Ed Wheeler, whereas The Infinite Man was a collaboration of myself and Dr. Rick Mooring. Well, if my arteries aren't flooded with goo from 10 days of eating fried everything, I'll be back next week with more tales and discussion from inside The Infinite Inning.
I'm going to Jackson, and that's a fact. Yeah, we're going to Jackson.